northeast wind, and increasing to 15 knots in the afternoon. Seas 5 feet. Let's check in to see if we have a meeting here. This is the borough assembly meeting.
Petersburg Borough Assembly meetings are brought to you by KFSK and Petersburg Wrangell Insurance, providing knowledge, professionalism, and information on insurance issues, commercial or pleasure, boat and crew. Petersburg Insurance, offering asset protection on the water or at home.
See, I haven't heard the meeting start yet. We're waiting for this. You are listening to Petersburg Borough Assembly meeting, starting just a minute or two here. And this is Suzanne Ash, your host. Just give it a minute, get it started. Where were we? In the marine weather, Sumner Street. West wind, 10 knots, at seas 2 feet or less. Tuesday, northeast wind, increasing to 15 knots and in the afternoon, and areas of fog in the morning. Tuesday night, east wind, 15 knots and seas 3 feet, Clarence Street. Southeast wind, 15 knots and seas 3 feet. Tuesday, southeast wind, 10 knots, seas 2 feet. And Cape Decision, Cape Edgecombe, tonight, north wind, 10 knots, becoming northeast late, sea 6 feet. And tomorrow, Tuesday, northeast wind, increasing to 15 knots in the afternoon, and seas 5 feet. So, gonna just listen to some more Benny Goodman here for a minute, and wait for the assembly meeting to begin.
Clerk, please call the roll.
John Hagerlet.
Here.
John Paul.
Here.
Mark.
Here.
Nancy.
Yes.
Sue.
Excused.
Kurt.
Here.
And Cindy.
Here.
Okay, it's now time for the voluntary pledge of allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay. Need approval of the meeting minutes for October 7th of 2013. Entertain a motion to do so.
Move to approve.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved by Member Haverlick, seconded by Member Strand, to approve the meeting minutes for October 7th of 2013. Any objections? All those in favor say aye.
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 Okay, the regular meeting minutes have been approved for October 7th of 2013. Is there any amendments to tonight's meeting agenda? If not, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes for this evening.
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Member Strand, seconded by Member Haverlick to approve the meeting agenda for this evening, October 21st. Okay, first thing on the agenda tonight is public hearings and bid awards. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak to Ordinance 2013-16? It's an ordinance providing for Chapter 4.24, entitled Property Tax, of the Municipal Code, updating current language to reflect borough incorporation, and updating various functions and dates to meet annual budget deadlines. Anybody in the audience like to speak to that? Okay, seeing nobody interested, the public hearing for Ordinance 2013-16 is closed. Now we have a public hearing on the proposed recycling program, and Public Works Director Mr. Hagerman will give a little rundown on the program.
Mr. Hagerman.
Perfect, leave us in the spotlight.
I've got to sit next to my computer, so I apologize for coming back to you guys.
That's your best side.
John and Cindy, Carl is going to give us a little slideshow here on the screen. So,
Mr. Mayor, the handout.
Oh, do you,
Mr. Mayor and Assembly? Tonight, I wanted to give a little more detailed rundown of the proposed changes for the recycling program. At the last meeting, it was basically just an introduction of the report that was completed to you and the public. And tonight I want to go through a little more detail on exactly what the program will do or is proposed to do for Petersburg and make sure there aren't any questions. Of course, field any questions and take any input that the Assembly or the public might have as we Sanitation Department looks at making a pretty substantial change to the recycling program in Petersburg. So I've got a presentation here I'll go through and open the floor when I'm done for questions. If anybody has any questions during the presentation, please hold them till the end so we can get through this, and for the sake of time, we'll just kind of try and get through this as quickly as possible. So, Recycling Petersburg, information and recommendations for positive change. Real briefly on the history of the recycling in Petersburg, we have always had drop-off locations. Started with many drop-off locations in town. Hammer and Weekon, the school district had one or two. South Harbor had one. That one was moved to the community cold storage. And the Baylor facility has always been open as a drop-off site. At this time, the Baylor facility is really the only site remaining due to misuse and litter accumulation at the other sites. Some private property owners requested that the sites be removed, and some were removed by the city or the borough to address problems. A few years ago, the Petersburg Indian Association had a great idea to employ some of their tribe members as to start a curbside recycling program. It was a free program that was started with grant money, and they basically just advertised it and signed people up and started collecting recycles, which were delivered to the city, baled, and then sent to market in Seattle. Eventually, the city did take responsibility for that program and and currently does as the borough. And now the borough is carrying that forward and looking to expand the program. Based mostly on the participation in the Southeast Alaska Solid Waste Authority, we are a charter member of that authority as a community, and the purpose and goals of that, of the authority, are to set up long-term solid waste management practices in the region, practice environmental stewardship, and create jobs where possible. The recent Master Services Agreement, basically our solid waste and recycling contract that was signed with Republic Services, does stabilize our costs for solid waste and recycling sales. For the long term, we have access now to a global recycling market through our vendor, which is Republic Services, a very large company in the solid waste world. The agreement also included pricing for commingled and single stream recycling programs, which is very important, of course, to our ability now to plan and compare program variables as we move forward. So this is a chart that was in the report, and it kind of goes into the track record that we've had in our recycling program. Recycling has always reduced the cost of solid waste disposal for Petersburg, but because we don't have very much recyclables, in relatively speaking, and the markets fluctuate so rapidly that the bottom line has very rarely been profitable. The couple things of note in here is in 2010 there's this big jump in revenues, which is related to scrap metal sales, excuse me. And then in 2011 there's a big jump in expenses, which is tied to the city's assumption of contracting with PIA for collection of the source separated materials, the curbside program that PIA began. And so the bottom line here, you can see, is we've been operating at a loss for the last 3 years. And this column right here, titled Avoided Disposal Cost, is just want to make sure people understand that this is not a, well, it is a true cost, but it is a cost that is born out of taking recyclables out of the waste stream and not paying full price for disposal as a solid waste. So the poundage that was removed from the waste stream in these years has a value as far as disposal cost, and that is it in this column right here. So there are quite a few advantages of going to a commingled system. Primarily, as I spoke of cost avoidance through recycling, our rough cost to dispose of solid waste in Petersburg is about $105 per ton. Our cost to recycle, there is still a cost to us for commingled recycling, is only $33 per ton. So it's about a third of the cost to the community to recycle, as opposed to sending that same waste stream to a landfill. The biggest advantage to the customer is convenience. No sorting of materials, no multiple bins, no hassle of where to put all this, these different containers of different materials. It simplifies the process dramatically for the customer to have one bin or one bag to put all of the recyclable material in. In a typical commingled recycling system, there is a wide variety of materials that are accepted, and Petersburg will be no different. EPA estimates that 75% of all national solid waste stream is actually recyclable. We in Petersburg sit at about 10.5% recycling rate, so we have a lot of room to improve on that number. Less handling of these materials by collection personnel streamlines the system and reduces costs in the long term. So this chart is also in the report, and it details the former chart was what we actually have experienced in the past as far as our recycling system expenses, revenues, and bottom line. This is a projection of what could happen. The costs of this that are used in this chart are the costs of disposal of solid waste and recovery of, or the cost of recycling as accessed by the new contract with Republic Services. So this could be looking into the future. If we achieve different recycling rates as a community, this shows what kind of savings that we could experience over our current expense. So at a 0% recycling rate, if we didn't recycle whatsoever, we would send about 2,500 tons of solid waste to the landfill at a cost of about $267,000. That's roughly our current budget. At our current recycling rate of 10.5%, the tonnage for solid waste goes down to 2,200. We would send 267 tons to recycling markets, and we could save potentially $19,000 over the course of a year in disposal costs. As the percentage, the recycling rate goes up, the solid waste goes down, and the recycling weight goes up, and the potential savings go up dramatically. If the recommendations for the program go into place and we achieve a 50% recycling rate within 7 years, we'll be saving theoretically $91,000 a year, which pays for a lot of infrastructure and program costs, as well as just general departmental costs of the sanitation department, and stabilizes rates dramatically without the need to increase rates to cover costs if we're saving that much money. So in looking at planning for that change, we know we have this opportunity to look at changes to the program. How best do we do that? I sat down with staff and at the sanitation department, also at PIA, to talk about what they thought. I had several ideas of what we could do, but it's always good to talk to the people that are on the ground and see it day to day. And they had some really good ideas about doing a limited scale trial to test out some of the ideas and see what would work and what wouldn't work here in Petersburg. So we organized a trial for Wednesday customers only, and these are the Wednesday recycling customers that have already volunteered for the source separated program. We used bags to contain and collect the material because they're weatherproof. It was very easy to distribute bags to the customers, and it was very easy to collect. PIA was on board with the trial, did a great job for us, adjusted to some difficulties. They did have to empty every single bag so we could see what was in there and make sure that it would bail as a loose material, as well as making sure that there wasn't anything that we didn't want to see in the bag. So they worked hard and did a great job for us on Wednesdays. It was a limited duration, and the focus was on data collection and feedback received from not only customers but from staff on the trial. So in actually putting the trial into practice, we sent letters out to the customers that would be affected, distributed bags. The materials that we collected were an expansion somewhat of what we have currently in the source separated program, and that it was aluminum, tin, paper, which included all mixed paper, junk mail, catalogs, magazines, that kind of thing, cardboard if it would fit in the bag, plastics with the exception of styrofoam and cellophane, and glass containers. The collection occurred for 6 weeks. The contractor emptied the bags at the baler, like I had said previously. We tracked the data. We had information before the trial began for several years back on what kind of weight we were seeing from those Wednesday customers. We didn't bring on new customers during the trial so we could compare apples to apples as far as numbers of customers. And we tracked the weight that we received during the trial. The materials that were received were baled by borough staff, and we didn't see any fatal flaws with any of the materials that we accepted. We were a little bit wary about how glass containers would bale, and if we would see a lot of shedding of glass from those bales that would cause problems for us, but it didn't appear to be a big a deal as we thought it might be. So again, no fatal flaws with that material. And so the results of the trial, when we got done and started crunching numbers, the pre-trial weight per household in the trial area, we were receiving 2.3 pounds per week per household. During the trial, we received 9.7 pounds per week. And these numbers, either one of those numbers aren't huge, but it does constitute over a 400% increase in the weight that we received from those customers. So if anything could be taken away from this, the sheer volume increase was very noticeable, and it was a lot more than I expected to see. The customers in the trial were very happy with the system. It was very easy to use for them. They saw noticeable reductions in the solid waste that were going in their trash can. And many did not want the trial to end. They wanted it to just continue on in perpetuity. So the system was also accepted by staff and the collection contractor. Very few negative comments towards the commingled stream. And ultimately found out that on paper it works, and in reality it will work for Petersburg. And so after the trial, started thinking about, okay, is this time? This is a big step, you know. Should we really be making this big of a change in Petersburg? The source separation recycling, the curbside program that has been ongoing, has been successful in that it has slowly gained popularity. When you separate materials and send those to market, there is a much higher value to some of those materials. So those kind of things really weigh heavily on, do we move away from that, or do we try and enhance that to make it all work? Ultimately, as I say here, the trial answered this question with just mostly because of the volume that was seen to increase during the trial. These are the same customers that have been recycling voluntarily for quite some time. Just the simple change to a commingled system increased the volume that they were recycling by 400%. I think that says a lot in what this simple change can mean to remove the more material from our waste stream and increase our recycling rate in a very short period of time. So the source separated program to succeed in the manner that a commingled program would need to depend on a huge increase in local participation, and really it was unlikely given the slow growth that we've seen in the program and the volumes that we were also seeing from that. So and my conclusion is yes, all indicators suggest a change to the commingled recycling system is warranted. One thing that that has come up a couple times during the analysis of this is whether or not recycling should be mandatory in Petersburg. It is the one sure way to get people involved and get participation is to put a ordinance in place that requires our customers to recycle. But nobody likes to be told what to do. The program has always been voluntary. There's about 30% of our residential customer solid waste customers that are recycling voluntarily. The customer base has grown steadily, very slowly, but it has grown. The thought of the convenience of the commingled program will surely recruit new voluntary members or customers right away. As well as the feedback that we got from the post-trial survey that indicated that while a majority of customers were very happy with the trial and wanted to see a change to commingled recycling, they did not want to be forced to do so. So it's recommended by the department to avoid any mandatory measures at this time in order to keep the voluntary aspect of it and to maintain a positive perception of the recycling program. Without mandatory recycling, however, it puts us into another problem of how to ramp up participation. To get the cost avoidance that we want from the disposal side, we have to incentivize participation. Our rate structure, as I've got here on the slide, is already set up to emphasize recycling and cutting costs for customers that have the larger service levels. anything above 32 gallons a week with a strong recycling program can be, the service can be dropped down to the next level and substantial savings can be realized right away by a customer. However, that's one thing I wanted to say, is that the lowest rate here, the 32-gallon service level, there is no lower service to go to by recycling. There is no incentive with this service level for somebody to remove material from their can and put it in a recycling container. But the cost is the same. There's no mechanism in our rate structure to do so. So the financial incentives... They are more motivational than other incentives like weighing on people's moral obligation and to protect the environment. That goes so far, people feel good about that, but when it affects their pocketbook, they seem to get more involved. It's just a fact of life. As well, with no guarantee of success of the commingled program, we could do all the preparation possible, but there's still a chance that after we go to this program, that we will not see the recycling rates that we need to offset disposal costs and save money to pay for the program. So we have to, as a department head, charged with making sure the sanitation department stays solvent, we have to make sure that the revenues coming into the department pretty much stay at the current level. By maintaining all of the rates that we have in the system, and only incentivizing that bottom rate, as I'll talk about here in a second, that revenue is retained to the, some extent. Either we'll get the same revenue that we already have, or if those folks recycle and drop down in service level, the disposal costs will go down dramatically because they'll be recycling. It's kind of a catch-22 in a good way, hopefully, that the more recycling we get, our costs will decrease. But again, that lower service level is the problem. So the current proposal is to implement a 20% increase to that lower 32-gallon service cost, but that increase will be waived if the customer participates in the recycling program. That 20% increase is equal to $5.53 per month, and results in a $33.16 monthly charge for that level of service. The existing rate is $27.63 per month. And so again, for those 32-gallon customers who recycle, sign up for the program, go through the process, their monthly cost does not change at all. It's the same, it's the $27.63. That only the incentive only kicks in if they decide that they do not want to recycle via curbside program. If they choose to do that and pay the higher rate, then that rate will help offset the cost of their lack of recycling, essentially. So in this way, we're trying to push forward the right choice of recycling, but at the same time we're trying to cover the revenue required to operate the department. And of course the customers in the higher service levels can achieve significant savings simply by recycling and then dropping their service level as they see that they have plenty of room in their can every week and they don't need that big of a can every week. And so talking about the cost of the program, the goal for me is to operate a new commingled system within the same revenue streams that we have now. There are many variables that go into developing a recycling system. Commingled versus source separated, we've talked about that. Potentially higher recycling rates, much higher recycling rates, point to commingled as the answer there. Borough collection versus contract collection. We have PIA collecting our curbside program right now. The lower contract labor costs kind of point us in that direction as far from a cost basis. Bag recycles versus cart collection is another question. And the lower initial capital costs of the bags have steered me in that direction as getting this program off the ground. And then in the long term, looking at the CART system, which most everybody associates with a successful recycling system, because of the higher capital costs of that and the need to use trucks to collect that material, if we get the program off the ground with bags and it really succeeds, it really does well and thrives, we ramp up our recycling rate dramatically and we see a lot of savings from our disposal side, then the capital outlays for purchasing collection carts and looking at different truck options becomes a lot more feasible. But getting off the ground and proving out the system is important. In the report, I talk about quite a few different options, which I've kind of boiled down right here to each option and what the costs are of each. And the source separated program, of course, is exactly what we're doing now. The labor in our contract is running about $53,000 a year. That would essentially stay the same. We could try to ramp up that system, expand the materials that are accepted, but again, the convenience of the commingled system it pretty much puts that out of consideration. Even though it is the lowest cost alternative, it won't achieve the recycling rates that we're after. I'm pretty convinced of that. Next option would be to move to a commingled system using 96-gallon carts and borough forces to collect it. With the 96-gallon carts, this option would look at every other week pickup of recycles and then every other week pickup of solid waste. Essentially, one week you'd put out your garbage, the next week you'd put out your recycles. And that way we can keep our fleet the same. We can use the same truck to do both of those, but we can't do them both on the same day. So we have to spread that out and do it every other week. It's feasible, although with the type of solid waste that we see in Petersburg, there's some thought on how if that's a really wise decision because of the fish and shellfish waste that can end up in those cans and could be pretty unpleasant for many people in the community. There is an increased O&M cost to our fleet. The labor that we would see, there would still be some room for some contract labor to pick up the junk mail at the post office, commercial cardboard, that kind of thing. It would be somewhat less than $53,000. It's hard to put a number on it without knowing exactly the scope of that. So a lot of these numbers are based on what we know the contract is today, but either there'll be less or more than, and I'll try to make that clear. So, and then moving on to the next option, which is commingled using 64-gallon carts and borough labor, and this would be weekly pickup to do a weekly pickup with our current forces or with borough forces. We would have a large capital expense of buying the carts, which is a little bit less than the 96-gallon carts, but still substantial, $65,000 for 64-gallon carts. We'd look at buying a used automated truck to pick up the material at $30,000. Truck O&M estimated at $10,000. Replacement costs so that we can buy another used truck after that one wears out, $5,000 a year. And this labor is a combination of one more employee for sanitation and the contract labor that would still be picking up the post office and other things. So this one adds up really quickly. That's a pretty expensive option to pick up weekly with borough forces. Moving on to getting in more to the contract labor side, if we go with 64-gallon carts, weekly pickup, and using our contractor, the capital costs are still the same for the carts. We still have a truck purchase because we need a truck to pick up those materials. We have the O&M and the replacement costs in that as well, but the labor goes down because we borough forces are not picking that up. Co-mailed bags and contract labor. The capital costs up front decreased dramatically. I'm estimating about $15,000 for bags over the course of a year. That probably will be less. I think that's a pretty conservative number. Of course, no capital cost for truck purchase or O&M replacement, and it would be this number for labor will probably be more than $53,000 in this, because this is the cost of our current program. Commingled, if every customer had commingled recycles out at the curb, it turns the collection effort up by about three times. Right now we've got about 25%, I think, that are recycling. So that $53,000 would surely go up, but not known how much it would. And so then the last option that I talked about in the report is using bags with borough labor to pick up the bag costs is the same as before. We've got a little more O&M in our trucks, and again we've got another employee and some contract labor to do the ancillary stuff. So in the end here, the option that we're looking at and recommending is to go with bags because of the lower capital costs up front. The labor is actually on the low side as well, although we know that's probably going to be a little bit higher as the full scope of the collection contract is known. So we see a first-year total cost of right around $68,000 and a recurring annual cost of about the same, $68,000. Hopefully this is good information, might generate some questions. It's very hard to say exactly what the numbers will be. These are all projections and they're very round numbers, but hopefully we're fairly close to what we would see in reality, and that will help guide the community and assembly to make a decision. And so in thinking about that bag system with contract labor, I just wanted to make sure people understood what that would look like. It would be the use of semi-transparent bags for collection. Customers would sign up at Public Works and pick up the bags there. We would actually distribute bags that were acceptable to the program, because we need to be able to see through them so that we can tell if materials that are supposed to be in there actually are, or if other materials are not. So it would contain aluminum, tin, mixed paper, flattened cardboard, plastics, unbroken glass containers, just as in the trial, and they would need to be sealed as it was put out to the curb so it was weatherproof. Recycling would be picked up on the same day as your normal trash, so you can place that out at the curb when you're setting out your can. The collection contractor would pick up the bags on that day and verify that there weren't any unwanted materials in the bag. If there were, for instance, a bunch of broken bottles in there that we didn't want to accept, they would be left, and still haven't figured out, of course, what kind of system we would use, but some kind of notification would be put on the bag saying, you got a problem here, please correct it, and then put those recycles out the following week for collection. And then as the bags were collected and delivered to the baler, they would be baled. They wouldn't have to empty the bags anymore. All the bags go on the baler belt. They're baled, put in a container, and off they go to Seattle for sorting down there and then marketing by Republic Services. And then in going over the implementation schedule, again, there was a memo that came out with the report that went over this, but I wanted to reiterate it, that if things keep rolling along as planned, the next meeting, November 4th, we'll have the first reading of a sanitation ordinance that would put into place the incentive language, or introduce the incentive language to the community. The second reading and public hearing for that ordinance would be on November 18th, and then on December 2nd, we could have the third reading of that ordinance, and if that is passed, then we'll have a much better idea of when the full program implementation will occur. I'm not intending, and I would like to write the ordinance so that the rate incentives don't take place until the rollout of the commingled program is actually happening, so that we don't increase rates on every 32-gallon customer in town, and then I don't implement the commingled system for, you know, 6 months. That would be flat wrong. So we want to avoid that. If the bag system continues to see support, it really does not take much time to roll that kind of a system out, and conceivably we could do that by January of 2014, which is just a couple months away. Collection contractor, our contract is up at the end of March, and so I do want to seek interest in Petersburg for that service. Basically go through another competitive process, request proposals from qualified firms or businesses to provide that service. That would start in February and be completed and a contract awarded by the 1st of April, so that we can continue the program without any hiccups. And then lastly, just wanted to talk about the goals that were discussed or pointed out in the very back of the report. Right now, Petersburg does recycle at a rate of about 10.5% per year. It would be great to see support for putting some goals in the ordinance that these are round numbers. I think they're very achievable, but within 3 years, achieve 30% recycling rate as a community, within 5 years hit 40%, and then within 7 hit 50% or higher. As I said, EPA believes that 75% of all the waste stream is recyclable, so there's actually greater potential than what we're proposing here. But it's something to shoot for, and if it's in the ordinance, then it requires the department to continually monitor that and adjust the program to try and reach those goals as best we can as time goes by. And so that's all I have tonight. The copies of the report are available on the website, the borough website, as well as hard copies at Public Works and the Finance Office and the Baylor. And if anybody from the public has any questions, comments, or feedback, please call Public Works at 772-4430, and please ask your questions and give us your input. We want this program to be successful, and the only way to make sure that we are is to get all the bases covered before we make the change. So, with that, I'll turn it back over to the mayor.
Assembly have a comment or questions of Carl? John?
Yeah, Carl, I had a couple thoughts. So one, going with the bag program, if your contractor used a big box truck, it seems like it could probably even go faster than the program now, because, you know, rather than stopping and sorting out and putting in the cans and taking the cans up to you know, up there, one driving and one walking along and just throwing the bag in the big box truck would go pretty fast. So Mike, actually keep the labor costs the same. And the other is, if this does catch on and, you know, we move to sort of modernize it and improve it going with the cans, the idea you have of going every other week, you know, 1 week with a 32-gallon for garbage and the next week with the recycle, that's perfect, because then you're using the same trucks and the same labor and really not having to increase much other than having to get the cans. And by people having to use a 32-gallon can every 2 weeks, that definitely encourages recycling. So, I really like what you've put together, and I'm real hopeful for it. And the other thing, saving $100,000 a year is, it's nice, and I like saving money.
Thanks for your comments. I think that you're absolutely right that the speed at which collection can occur with the bag system is going to be better. It's just it's unknown how much that will be offset by the hopefully the dramatic increase in customers. But there's a lot of different ways to look at it, and saving money is the goal with this.
Yeah, I see this as just all positives.
Thank you.
I really appreciate all your work on it.
Thank you.
Anybody else on the assembly? Kurt?
Mr. Mayor. Hey, Carl, you know, your estimated annual cost of $68,000, that's not projecting any increase at all, is it? I mean, right now you're just looking at what the status quo is?
That would be an initial cost. The rates are already programmed in the ordinance to go up every year for the next 4 or 5 years. So those rates would continue to march along. They were set up to cover capital costs and projects of the department. This cost scenario is really looking more at the operational side, labor and supplies of the department, and the service of solid waste disposal is obviously a big part of our budget that if we can save money on, it would make a huge difference. But to answer your question, yeah, it is pretty much flat. It doesn't really, I don't have my crystal ball, isn't working very well to know if how much that's going to go up or down after the initial start of the program.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I could envision that labor cost going up because of, you know, having to stop at more houses is all I was thinking of. So that $68,000 is just kind of a target to start with. But
yes,
it could very well go up to $85,000 or $90,000, you know, if you have 30% or 40% participation. So that's going to offset then the initial or the actual costs of the recycling program, because at some point there I thought we were going to save $91,000 if we hit the 50 percentile.
Right.
So do you foresee us spending all of that money just in recycling then, or is there going to be actual cost savings to the city?
It could all go to the recycling program, okay. Or we could save money and do good things with that. It's so hard to say. I can't. I'd love to say no. We're going to save money and this is going to be fantastic. But I can't say that. I don't know. Yeah. It's the only thing we can do is set up a program that we believe is going to work very well, that gives us the opportunity to save a lot of money and push hard to have efficiencies in that collection, to try and control costs, expenses of that program as much as possible, and set ourselves up to save as much money as possible.
Hey, thanks, Carl. Yeah, good work.
Nancy, do you have a question of Carl? Or?
I don't think that I increased to 9.7. It was not having to deliver my cardboard and office paper to the baler. The convenience of commingled is wonderful. Yeah. And as far as fish waste being picked up every other week, that works for me. When I have fish waste in the summer, I put it in the freezer till garbage morning, and then it goes in the garbage can. So I don't attract bears.
It's a good way to do it.
Easy enough way to do.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like there'll be a learning curve involved for everybody.
Absolutely.
So, for instance, Carl, have you thought if the program doesn't work, if it generates more of a cost, would we revert back than savings? So would we revert back to what we're using now?
Probably not. We'd probably stick with commingled, but we'd have to adjust the program to maybe try and extract some, kind of do a hybrid system that extract some of the higher value materials. If it's there, if milk jugs, for instance, are easily separated from the commingled stream, if aluminum is easily separated from the commingled stream, both of those commodities have higher prices as separate commodities, sending them as a one bale of HDPE has a significantly higher cost or revenue potential than including in a commingled stream. But then you get back into, well, it's not as convenient anymore, and customers, will they do it or not? And so the volume will go down. If they decide, no, I'm not going to separate, I've had it. This is great. This commingled system was fantastic. I didn't have to sort anything. I only had one container. If they're going backwards, then I'm going to stop doing it. Then we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot there too, because not only do we not get the milk jugs and the aluminum, it all goes in the landfill, and we have to pay for that. So it's a tough question, and like I said, the crystal ball is a little murky. But as a department, we need to keep pushing the fact that this is a good thing to do. It does save money, and try to make it as easy as possible for people to follow through with, and then I think we'll be successful.
Okay, thanks. Anybody from the audience, since this is a public hearing, have any comments or questions for Carl? Okay, seeing none, I guess the public hearing on the proposed recycling program is closed. Thank you, Carl.
You're welcome.
And that brings us to the next item on the agenda, which is a bid award. And there was a bid for light standards in the harbor. And there was two people that bid on the project, OW Enterprises and Bear Electric. And from Power and Light Superintendent Joe Nelson, he recommends that the award be made to OW Enterprises for 35 units for a total amount of $15,988.35. And this comes from a budget line item for streetlights and signals. So I would entertain a motion to award this bid to OW Enterprises of Petersburg. Okay, it's been moved by Member Strand, seconded by Member Haverlick, to award the bid for 35 light standards to OW Enterprises not to exceed $15,988.35. Will the clerk call the roll?
Kurt?
Yes.
Nancy?
Yes.
John Hogue?
Yes.
Cindy?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
And John Haverlick?
Yes.
Okay, the bid will be awarded to OW Enterprises. Next item on the agenda is visitors' views related to the agenda. See no one in the audience that has views related to the agenda. I know of one person that has views unrelated to the agenda, so sorry it's taken us so long, but would you please step to the microphone and state your name and who you represent?
Hi, I'm Rosalie Grant, and I work for the Department of Fish and Game, the Division of Subsistence. And I'm here just to let you know that the Division of Subsistence, we're doing some historical research on the Stikine River, specifically the Stikine River Chinook.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
I cannot hear the speaker.
Is the microphone working, Matt? Or
yeah.
Does it just...
Well, she's at the podium, John, and I don't know if you're getting the input from the microphone that Matt has set up there or not. But we'll
see if it'll work now.
Okay,
That sounds louder now. Okay, so the Division of Subsistence, we're conducting historical research on the Stikine River, specifically the Stikine River Chinook. And part of our study is we would like to interview people in the local communities around the Stikine, which includes Telegraph Creek, Wrangell, and Petersburg. And so we're looking for people to interview who, just to collect stories about the Stikine River and maybe any changes they've seen in the environment around there, or changes they've seen in the fishing, and specifically any changes they've seen related to Chinook salmon, especially anything pre-1976. So, and I think I sent you all an email about it a few weeks ago. But it was a bit of a long email, too, so I'd be surprised if anybody read the full thing.
So. Have you had any input from anybody in the
communities? Oh, yeah, we have.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So it's been a good start so far. But what I'm hoping to do is take this as an opportunity to record some of Petersburg history and kind of record the importance of the Stikine River to Petersburg and the importance of King Salmon to the community and use it. I don't know. We can put it in our archives, hopefully.
Okay. Thanks. Any questions of Rosalie?
Kurt, how do we get in contact with you?
I work for Fish and Game, so you could call the office down there. Yeah.
We just go over to their office if they have any information.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I work out of Juneau though now too, but they have my contact information.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
All right. Rosalie. Thanks.
Okay, next item on the agenda, we're going to have a report from District Ranger Jason Anderson. I believe he's going to talk about herbicides.
Thanks for having me again. I was asked to come and kind of give a presentation about the Forest Service policy for herbicides on public lands. I think it's come up in the context of three different weed management plans that have been presented most recently by both the Forest Service, the State of Alaska Department of Transportation, and then a third plan that was presented or prepared on behalf of the community community of Petersburg. I think that was done by the Alaska Association of Conservation Districts. There was a presentation here few weeks ago by Brian Maupin, who presented that plan, which is really a good assessment for Petersburg and municipal lands within the boundary of the borough, rather, for the invasive plants that you have and how you might choose to treat them. So while that was coming out, the Forest Service also had its environmental assessment and decision notice for a two-district, the Wrangell and Petersburg Ranger District's invasive weed management plan, and then right around the same time frame was the Department of Transportation's plan on vegetation management. So what I'm here to talk about is what the Forest Service's plan is proposing to do and just some of the policy behind that plan. So for those that haven't seen it or if you're interested in looking at it, the environmental assessment has been completed. It's been on the street for public comment and appeals. The decision in there effectively establishes on both the Wrangell and Petersburg Ranger Districts a programmatic way to treat known and or future populations of invasive weeds. And invasives are actually defined in the plan as, I'll overgeneralize, but plants we don't want that have some sort of negative ecological consequence of thriving and persisting. Usually they're very aggressive. Some of them have toxic interactions with other native species. Some of them can have livestock concerns. So there's a whole host of things, reasons why a plant might be considered invasives. There's actually many of them on Mitkoff Island, according to Brian Maupin's presentation. However, the nice thing about Alaska generally is, unlike the lower 48, where they're spending billions of dollars annually to try and get rid of them, we're at a place ecologically where we have really a lot of opportunity to get in front of the populations that have established and knock them back. In fact, in some cases, even eradicate those populations rather than just figure out how to coexist and deal with the consequences. So the proposal from the two districts was to try and get our hands around the populations that we know about and be prepared to respond to populations that may emerge in the future from unknown sources or somewhat even predictable sources. The way in which we go about doing that is considered integrated pest management. You'll hear this terminology throughout many different sectors of land managers, and really what it's talking about is looking at every tool in the toolbox for the treatment of invasives, mechanical, biological, and herbicides. And herbicides, of course, especially in our environment with a lot of rain, really lucrative fisheries, a subsistence way of life, herbicides gets a lot of criticism, a lot of concern. And so one of the things that I wanted to bring up was just the way in which the Forest Service has approached this. It's based upon national policy as well as the direction in our local plan, the two districts. The policy is actually out of our Washington office. It's a Forest Service Manual 2100 for Environmental Management, and it tiers to several existing public laws that regulate how pesticides, rodenticides, and herbicides are used throughout the country, and specifically by federal agencies. So the Federal Insecticide FIFRA, sorry, acronyms are great. It's the Federal Insecticide Herbicide, or no, I apologize. Can't quote it off the top of my head. Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act of 1947 pretty much just establishes how those pesticides will be regulated for use by the federal government. There's the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which talks about how the Forest Service and other federal entities have to deal with the disposal of those herbicides if, in fact, we have them in our inventories. The Clean Water Act talks about the distribution of those herbicides, when we need to use them on or near waterways, navigable waterways of the United States. So there's, again, that whole host of laws. And probably the biggest one for the Forest Service, the one that most of our the publics are familiar with, is NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which really defines how the Forest Service will go about analyzing the effect of the action proposed, as well as involving the public and creating alternatives around that proposed action. So in the case of the Wrangell and Petersburg districts, what we proposed was to take a look at the existing population of invasive weeds, those that we don't want, that we don't want to manage in some way, tolerate in some way, identify that inventory, and then start dealing with the treatment of those through integrated pest management. So where biological controls would work, we would use them. Where mechanical controls would work, where we'd use them. But in instances, either by location or most of the time species, the type of plant, we may choose to use herbicides simply because we know certain plants do not respond well, or you can't get the control you're after with just mechanical or biological means. And for those that are familiar, mechanical might be mowing, pulling, bagging, burning. Biological could be the introduction of other organisms. This has been around since about the 1950s, but certain plants that have immigrated from other places, there are other ecosystem cohorts that don't come with them, things that eat them. And so there have been successful models where they've imported the things that eat that plant and have had good control over them. There's a lot of emphasis on evaluating the plant that's being targeted for biological control, because what you wouldn't want to have happen is a similar cousin to the import being a great food source for that other thing you're bringing in to control it. And when the target plant is gone, now it's feeding on some cash crop. We don't use a lot of it in the Forest Service, though it has been used in the country, and it is part of an integrated pest management program. I think the relevant piece for here is really that use of herbicide, which is in our plan. But the proposal is really to use very selective applications. We aren't doing any kind of broadcast spraying. It's basically hand spraying, direct stem injection in some cases, painting leaves in some cases. It would really depend upon the plant we're targeting, the sensitivity of the environment in which we're operating, the size of the population we're targeting, the logistics of getting into and from that site. But the range of techniques used to control plants with herbicides is not just limited to, you know, aerial distribution or truck-mounted booms. I've seen, again, syringe-based stem injection techniques. I've seen where they cut and then paint the stems that have been cut. I've seen, mister bottles that are used, spray bottles to spray individual leaves of the plants. Brian, the Alaska Association of Conservation Districts representative that was here, talked about a project where in which they put big rubber gloves on, cotton gloves over the rubber, dipped the cotton gloves in the herbicide, and then just brushed the plants. And all of that was based upon protecting the aquatic environment. They don't want any side drift or drippings to end up in a sensitive environment. So all of those application techniques would be open and available to the Forest Service as it tries to deal with the known populations of invasives on Mitkof, well, actually throughout the two ranger districts, so not just Mitkof, but QU, Kuprinoff, et cetera. We only looked at three chemicals for the herbicide component. Those are the most common use chemicals in existence that are regulated under the Federal Insecticide and Rodenticide Act. They have to be a regulated chemical. We did a pretty extensive analysis on the level of toxicity and concentration levels, and I can't cite all of it tonight, but the document does a fairly thorough job of explaining what the human risk and environmental risk of using those chemicals is at the frequencies which we'd use them. So, for my part, I feel as if we've taken a very conservative approach to the target, which is controlling invasive weeds that have an ecological effect on our environment, and in doing so in the most responsive manner without excluding one of the potential tools that can be very effective. A really good example in our area that many are probably familiar with is the knotweed, either Japanese knotweed or some people refer to it as Bohemian knotweed. You can be really aggressive with the weed whacker, with your pet goats, with your weed burner, whatever you've got, it's coming back. And the one thing they have found is that the integrated approach to both mechanical treatments and then following up with herbicide treatments is one of the most effective ways to get rid of that. Brian talked about examples where they were digging out soil, chopping down the pieces into less than quarter-inch segments, bagging them up and getting rid of them. And any time that little quarter-inch piece of plant remained, it would actually propagate, sprout, and start the whole process over. So, I mean, there are species out there that just do not respond to anything other than some effective herbicide application. So knowing that we have those plants, knowing that we can be very controlled in the application, that our intent is not to just do it for cost-effective means, but to do for a control mechanism, try to achieve your control objectives, we do have a herbicide use application, or at least a provision for herbicide use. In order to act upon that, however, I have to produce what's called a pesticide use plan annually. I have to have certified pesticide use applicators that go through training. We have to go through the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permitting process. It's a fairly regulated process for us to use herbicides. And then personally, as district ranger, I don't have the authority to approve them for use in wilderness. That actually has to go to the regional forester. So pretty regulated system. We have dozens of different species, invasives. Most of the populations are relatively small. There are a few exceptions, probably the most difficult of which that we'll deal with is on the stikeen, and that's canary reed grass, or reed canary grass. It's really tall, wild grass. You'll see it here well into the summer and even early fall. It'll still be the tallest green grass growing out along the road shoulders. Was used very commonly by road crews in the Forest Service years ago to reestablish slopes. You can use it for seeding, and it grows really fast and protects the dirt from being eroded by runoff. it just does such a great job that it can actually anchor the stream banks and completely change the stream dynamics when it gets into riparian systems. Would definitely be classified as something not friendly to fish, and yet it exists. There's a lot of it. So there are some places where the tactic on something like reed canary grass would not be eradication because we don't have enough money to do so. It would be just to maintain it where it's at, prevent the continued spread of that population. And one way to do that is through early detection and rapid response. And so that's another key component to the plan between the two districts is when we find a known population migrating or a new population in a place we hadn't seen it before, this particular decision gives us the authority to very quickly go in and respond to that with the appropriate tools. It might just be tarping it, in other words, putting on black fabric to prevent sunlight from getting to it and kind of cook that on the spot, or it may just require us to go in and pull it all by hand and bag it up and take the seed stock away, or in some cases, some of the more severe cases, we may choose to do some herbicide treatment. But the whole thing was just jump on them quickly, deal with the new populations as they emerge to keep them from becoming, no pun intended, rooted. And then for those that are really large, look at the most cost-effective strategy for dealing with them. Because in some cases, I don't think removal or eradication will be possible. It's just it's too far gone in some places. But if anyone is interested, again, we have copies of the environmental assessment. And then if the Assembly is interested in terms of just Forest Service policy and how we look at the various public laws and departmental regulations in applying these types of projects on public lands, I'm more than happy to provide that information.
Okay.
You bet.
Questions?
John?
Yeah, I have a couple, Jason.
You bet.
How many thousands of miles of road do you oversee?
On the Petersburg District, I want to say we're in upwards of around 1,200 to 1,300 miles, and the disposition of that is I'm not entirely familiar with. Some is open, some is closed, or some is open to motorized use, some is not open to motorized use.
If we're looking at all of, say, southeast, it'd be a couple.
It's about 6,000 miles, I think, across all of southeast. Those are rough figures. The Forest Service has been pretty actively closing roads over the last 4 or 5 years, so getting that roads infrastructure is a national issue.
And I'm very impressed with the process you go through, and because it does seem to be very protective of streams and habitat, mm-hmm. and public land, people's use of public land, berries, things like that. Is this this process that was developed, is that it's been in effect since 1940 something, or improved since then, or
the management of herbicides and other toxic products in the federal system has been around a long time. Mm-hmm. Insecticide, rodenticide, and fungicides, herbicides, those have been regulated probably since the mid 1940s, and I think FIFRA was one of the earliest ones. And there have been a whole host of other environmental laws that have come into play on how to manage that system. But integrated pest management as a concept, I think, has also been around probably since the 50s, and is I'd say in my time with federal service, it's become really strong since about the mid 80s on.
And this has all been federally regulated for quite a while.
Yeah.
Do you ever cross with state roads?
We do. There are, the state has rights of way over Forest Service, over public mm-hmm. lands. The state maintains its rights of ways, but within that right of way, the state has jurisdiction to maintain that road corridor.
In that maintenance, are they allowed to spray whichever way they want, or do they have to follow federal guidelines?
I believe it depends on what was conveyed under that right of way. In many instances, they're given the right to manage the vegetation, and the application of herbicides, I believe, would be acceptable. But it is an interesting question for portions of public land that have a state right of way. What is the when there's a proposed action by one entity? Does it produce what they call a federal nexus, which would trigger some level of analysis by the Forest Service, which would then trigger this policy that dictates all of the things I briefly described. So in fact, it's probably something worthwhile for me to take back and ask, just in terms of proposals on state rights of way.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any more questions of Jason?
Yes, Mr. Mayor, this is Cindy.
Okay, so...
Just so I know, but even though you have the overarching document, don't you also let the public know and give a chance to comment on proposed actions for doing any herbicide management?
Yeah, I guess I sort of glazed over the NEPA process. One of the guiding laws in our policy is to meet the requirements of the National Environmental Policy Act. So typically what that looks like is defining up front what kind of analysis you think you're going to have to perform, either an environmental assessment or environmental impact statement, and then scoping the proposed action with the public. So loosely describing the proposed activity, giving the public an opportunity to comment on that, using those comments to then refine the proposed action and develop any alternatives to it. So for the environmental assessment that we concluded, the alternative to it was one that didn't include herbicides. Knowing that that was the single point of controversy, what we ended up with was no action. What would it look like if we did nothing? The proposed action was integrated pest management, so the use of herbicides in addition to all other forms of treatment. And then the third action was everything but herbicides. And then public has an opportunity to comment on the environmental analysis of all three alternatives, and they're compared and contrasted. So here's the accomplishments we think we'd get with no action, here's what we think we'd get with the proposed, and here's what we get with alternative one, you know, the alternative. And then the public has that opportunity to comment back on that analysis and then actually appeal that after the decision comes out. They can also then choose, if they have standing, appeal the decision. So pretty extensive public involvement process. We've been working on this one for actually about 2 years.
Does that answer your question, Cindy?
Hang on just a second, I have to put my earphones out or else my voice comes back at me. What I was asking was not the NEPA analysis on the integrated pest management plan, but say you wanted to treat recent areas of Thomas Dekeen, you would then make a proposal to do that and give the public the comment at that point too.
I don't believe the pesticide use plan has another round of public comments. We would do a notification just because we're treating. Well, it depends on the treatment. So I don't think categorically, Cindy, we would have another public notification process after the environmental analysis, unless we were proposing something that would. What's that?
Well, it's hard to understand you, Cindy. I don't know if it must just be our speaker on the phone here. So, Jason, I don't think understood the question.
Let me try this. I unplugged the earphone.
Now it's
can you hear me now?
Lots better. Better. Yes, sorry. We can.
But she can't.
So, can
us.
You re-ask?
I hear you.
Well, we have a dilemma. Because it's only working.
Okay, I think he's answered the question.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Any other questions of Jason? Okay, seeing none. Thanks for the report, Jason.
Thanks. You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, now we're on to board, commission, and committee reports. There is none. Consent agenda, there's no items on the consent agenda this evening. Report of other officers, there's the mayor's report. We're seeking letters of interest. The borough is seeking letters of interest from qualified citizens who wish to serve the community as a member of the borough assembly or the library board. Both of those have a vacancy. Assembly member Sue Flint has announced her retirement effective after the November 4th meeting, and Ann Hurt retired from the library board on September 30th. On that topic, so far we have received one letter of interest for Sue's seat when she steps down off the borough assembly, and that is from Bob Lynn. So I'm thinking if we schedule a meeting for the 25th of November, we'll talk about that here in a little bit. Maybe that's when we could go over the applicants and choose to fill that seat, and hopefully we'll have letters of interest for the library board as well. Rescheduling the meeting for November 18th. There won't be a quorum because there will be too many people gone for the Alaska Municipal League. I think we should schedule a meeting for 7 p.m. on November 25th. We're going to have quite a bit of business to do on the December 2nd meeting. Does that work for other assembly members? 25th of November at 7 p.m.?
Fine with me.
John Hogue, it works for me.
Cindy, will you be here? All we need is four, I guess.
Yes, I will.
Okay, well, Kathy, can you schedule that? And then maybe that will be the meeting where we will intend to appoint somebody to fill Assemblymember Flint's possession until next year's election. Okay, reminder on noncompliance hearings. In conjunction with the December 2nd Assembly meeting, the Assembly will conduct noncompliance hearings regarding, well, it was two structures, now it's only one. The owner has removed his structure. Okay, we'll take a minute here. We must have ran over our limit on our phone bill.
Hello?
Well, if it gets too difficult, we'll just continue with the four of us. We still have a quorum. Are you going
to... I still think we ought to invest in metal chips to put in everyone's head.
That would be a good idea. I think they do that with pets, don't they? For the people in the radio audience, we lost our two members that were participating by phone. We'll give them a try, and if it doesn't work, we'll continue on.
And you are listening to Petersburg Borough Assembly meeting on KFSK, and please stay tuned.
I'll turn it on.
There you go.
Hold on, John. We're going to try it again.
All right. I hear.
Okay, we're going to try it again. Hold on a second. John and Cindy?
I'm here. I'm
good. Good, you're back. Okay, we're still under the mayor's report. The reminder of the noncompliance hearing for the two deemed dangerous structures will be on December 2nd, except there's only going to be one building. So the other one's been removed by the owner. Work session reminder, the joint work session between the hospital board and assembly will be Thursday, December 5th at 9 a.m. Topics to be covered, finances, and proposed borough code 3.50 that addresses the hospital board. And that brings us to the city manager's report, and I've asked the borough clerk to go over the manager's report, if she would. The manager is homesick. He's got a flu bug, so hopefully he gets better.
Okay, for the police department, investigators from Alcohol Beverage Control provided a refresher training for our officers on October 9th, and they also completed compliance checks at local establishments. Chief Sweetheart attended the school district planning meeting on emergencies. Officers Holgrim and Kerr visited with kindergartners on October 4th. Officer Williams is scheduled to attend death and homicide investigation course. Course dates are in December. She's also scheduled to attend Forest Science Certification in Scottsdale, Arizona in January, and that was by scholarship. Certification will allow for analyzing use of force incidents, which will improve officer safety as well as potentially reduce borough civil liability. AT&T has corrected the way E911 surcharges are collected for Petersburg. The borough should see an increase in revenue as we will be receiving all the surcharges that are due us. As a reminder to the public, the E911 surcharges could only be used for personnel, training, and equipment directly related to answering and processing of 911 calls. And thus, also State Representative Jonathan Chris Tompkins toured the police department in early October. For the electric department, they're gearing up for major maintenance work at the hydro during the week of October 28th. and they'll be inspecting, testing, and cleaning equipment. And also, Joe will be attending the Alaska Electric Utility Conference in October at the end of this month. Fire EMS, Sandy attended the Local Emergency Planning Committee Association and State Emergency Response Commission meetings last week in Anchorage. The joint Petersburg-Wrangell LEPC will be separated and operate independently after this grant cycle. And library, they have received funding from the state of Alaska's Online with Libraries project to add 7 hours per week of staff time for technology-related tasks. The grants will run through June 2014. And also, the library will be closed November 2nd and Monday, November 4th to complete their shelving installation. Public Works. Carl is working with ADOT manager Mike Etcher on the Haugen Drive crosswalk issues. Carl understands the safety concerns and is looking into establishing a 2nd Street crosswalk prior to the 2015 road project. The contractor for Pump Station 5 project is targeting startup and testing of the new equipment for this week. The new pumps could be online by the weekend. Rockin' Road has brought in a subcontractor, S&S General Contractors, for the landfill that has experience in working with similar dredge placement. The work has resulted in a successful placement of the spoils from the harbor on the landfill slopes, and the containment berm is working to contain any spoils that will not hold on the slopes. With the end of the dredging in sight, Carl's confident that all the spoils will be contained at the landfill, and the intent of the landfill contract will be very close to being met. And for the harbors, North Harbor dredge remains on schedule. By the end of the day on Friday, that's October 11th, the Corps of Engineers officially signed off on Areas 1 and 2. And the harbor has sent Ben Hind, our maintenance person, down to a trip to visit the construction yard to observe how they're making headway on preparation of the floats for construction. And they're working with PNND to finalize invitation and bid of the Drive Dock project. That's it.
Okay, thank you very much, Kathy. I probably would have ran out of steam if I had to read that as well, but... Now we're on to unfinished business and ordinances for the third and final reading. The first ordinance this evening for the third and final reading is Ordinance 2013-14, an ordinance providing for Chapter 4.36 of the Municipal Code and updating current language to reflect borough incorporation. I'd entertain a motion to adopt that ordinance in its third and final reading.
So moved.
Second.
Been moved by Member Haverlick, seconded by Member Strand to adopt Ordinance 2013-14 in its third and final reading. Any discussion? John or Cindy, you have any input?
None.
Okay, will the clerk call the roll?
John Haverlick.
Yes.
Kurt?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Nancy?
Yes.
John Hogue?
Yes.
Cindy?
Yes.
Okay, Ordinance 2013-14 passes in its third and final reading, 6-0. The next ordinance is 2013-15, an ordinance providing for Title VI of the Municipal Code and updating current language to reflect borough incorporation. I'd entertain a motion to adopt this ordinance in its third and final reading.
So move.
Second.
Moved by Member Haverlick, seconded by Member Strand to adopt 2013-15 in its third and final reading. Any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Cindy.
Yes.
John Hogue.
Yes.
Nancy.
Yes.
Kurt.
Yes.
John Haverlick.
Yes.
And Mark.
Yes. Okay, Ordinance 2013-15 passes in its third and final reading, 6-0. Now we're on to ordinance for the second reading. The only ordinance tonight under the second reading is Ordinance 2013-16, This is an ordinance providing for Chapter 4.24, entitled Property Tax, of the Municipal Code, updating current language to reflect borough incorporation, and updating various functions and dates to meet annual budget deadlines. Entertain a motion to adopt this in its second reading.
So move.
Second.
It's been moved by Member Haverlick, seconded by Member Strand, to adopt Ordinance 2013-16 in its second reading. Any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Kurt.
Yes.
Nancy.
Yes.
John Hogue.
Yes.
Mark.
Yes.
John Haverlick.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
Okay, Ordinance 2013-16 passes in its second reading. That brings us to the Juneau appeal of the Petersburg borough boundaries. There's no new information on that yet. Is there anything, Kathy?
Not a thing.
No? Hopefully the Superior Court will make a ruling on that fairly soon. So they have almost 2 more months, I believe, or 4 more months. They have 6 months to make a decision, so it could drag on for a while. Redistricting, there's no new information there either. So that brings us up to review of Parks and Recreation Advisory Board. So I believe the chair of that board is here tonight. Is that, are you the chairman? No, you're not. You're just here as a supporter of it? Okay. I would entertain a motion to open this for discussion.
So moved.
I'll second.
Been moved by Member Strand, seconded by Member Loganakis to go to either approve or not approve of keeping the Parks and Recreation Board. Donnie, would you like to say anything? I've read the report. I think all of the assembly members have.
I don't have anything to add, Mayor.
Okay.
Unless you would like me to speak on it directly.
Well, all of these advisory boards that we're going over, if we don't within the first year, they just kind of go away. So the Parks and Recreation Board, the director of Parks and Rec, in his comment, feels that the board has a purpose, but it could probably be done with just an ad hoc committee as well. So keeping an elected board, in his opinion, is not necessary for this function. But I see there's one member in the audience that would you like to say something about it, Donna? Or just...
Sure, impromptu.
You can if you'd like. I know.
I did not come prepared to speak, but I will.
You don't... I mean, I just thought I'd offer, since you're here and you're interested in this subject.
Well, I would like to, I guess, a plea for this continuation. Donna Marsh, yes. Continue a plea to keep the board as an elected body, because I think an ad hoc thing sometimes gets lost in life, and it's not as noticeable, I think, as somebody actually submitting their name to be on a ballot to put it forth. Now, Donnie was the one who approached me, whatever it was, to see, hey, are you interested in running for Parks and Rec Board? And I appreciate that opportunity. I've learned a lot. But I think it gives a little more cohesiveness if we have running information, if we have, we're up to date on current information with what's going on, rather than just, oh, let's form a new committee each time a crisis or an issue comes up. So I would urge the assembly to consider keeping it as an elected board.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other input from assembly members?
Yeah, I'll make a comment here. I've talked to some of the other members on there, and they also feel the same as Donna. They would like to keep it as a committee, as a board.
So. Nancy, you have...
My only question is, if we keep it now, we can always disband it later?
I would believe it could be dissolved. Is that your feeling, Kathy? Or?
Well, right now, if you're going to approve to keep it, we're going to go and we're going to redo the ordinance, and it's going to be an ordinance format. And it would just be after you'd have to repeal the ordinance if you put it into effect.
And if we disband it now...
If you do nothing, it's going to go away on its own.
Uh-huh. And then if we decide we need it later, what kind of a hassle is that?
Well, you can either do an ordinance process then, or you can determine you're going to do it for just appoint them for ad hoc for a certain item, or again, put them back into active like it has been in the last, 10-15 years.
But if we retain it as it is now, then in the future we'll just have to repeal an ordinance.
Yes.
Well, if the board feels a need, I don't have a problem retaining them for one more election cycle.
Reading through the report, I mean, the second item is how many referred items did the board / committee address over the past 2 years that were referred by the assembly or
manager, and it was none. So maybe that just means Don is running a good program. There's no need for board input. But I'm all in favor of, okay, I'll get 10 minutes, of having boards if there is issues so we don't have to hash it out in the assembly at this level. So, Cindy?
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, I think that this is one type of advisory committee that many communities have, and where there is there's a transition that's happening after Judy Portney's retirement. I would advocate keeping them for at least one more cycle.
Okay, so somebody, I think maybe do we need a motion to retain the Parks and Rec Advisory Board, if that's the desire of some of the members?
So
as an elected body to contain 5 members is, I believe, what it has been in the past.
So move.
So you make the motion, and Nancy, do that. Member Strand would make a motion to keep the Parks and Rec Advisory Board. It was seconded by Member Wallhooter. So is there any more discussion? Yes.
If I could.
Sure.
Just
for the audience, Donnie, I mean, everybody probably recognizes your voice.
Donnie Hayes, Parks and Recreation Director. I guess my point would just be is that in the past that we've met one time where we actually discussed an issue that was dealing directly with Parks and Recreation that was brought to the board by a group of citizens. The rest of the time, any time that we've had a meeting, they've been items that have been brought up by the Parks and Recreation Director that have been put on the agenda, and they typically have dealt with either the budget or capital improvement projects. Otherwise, we haven't had a meeting, and as you look at the ordinance, the way that the board is actually supposed to be managed is that those items are supposed to be coming from, you know, the head of that body and then also that group of members. And the way that this board has been run to this point is that as the director, I feel like I come to the meeting and give them a rundown of what we're doing at Parks and Recreation, but there typically isn't any other items that are brought by the board themselves. And when you look at the ordinance, that's what the ordinance says that is supposed to happen. If we continue the board, which is fine with me. I mean, I came to Donna because I do believe that we need to have discussion by the community about a community group. I mean, I'm using taxpayer dollars to make sure that we have great recreation and great facilities. I want to make sure that I'm doing the right thing by the community. My problem is that having an advisory board to have an advisory board for me to share information about what I'm doing isn't effective. But if it's a board that is there that is generally ready to share input and give ideas and to come and actually manage that board themselves, I don't have a problem with that.
Okay. Kurt?
No, go ahead.
This is really reminiscent of my early days on the Harbor Board. Guys just showed up for the coffee, let Jim Strumdahl tell them what they were going to do, and then everybody went home. Well, I got elected as the chairperson, and I started asking questions. I started saying, what is my authority as a board member? And Hickman told me, he said, what is it you're looking for? And I said, what can I get?
You know, I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, it's just a matter of just, you know, stepping up. I mean, nobody ever saw the budget ever until I asked for it for the very first time. And then Strumdahl said, what do you want that for? And I said, I thought that was something that we were supposed to do, is look at the budget and help you formulate where we were spending our money. And he says, no. He said, but I'll give it to you. You know, but it was that sort of thing. And now look at where they've gotten to, you know. I mean, I'm not saying that I brought them to where they were, but, you know, I mean, I think that maybe if our board members knew exactly what sort of authority they had, maybe they don't know how far they can go with it. They don't know if they can approach you with new ideas, you know, or that. But, I mean, I think if we take these boards away, I certainly don't want the responsibility of having to listen to the public, even though I will, you know, bring up these little issues. I think it's great to have a board, you know, that does all the sounding boards for us and then brings us their recommendations. And 9 times out of 10, or I'd say 99.9% of the time, I'm just going to go ahead and rubber stamp whatever a board has come with their findings, because they've done all the legwork. And that's something that I would do, but, you know, it's nice not to have to. So anyway, I think maybe they just need a little nurturing, and I think that maybe they'll take off, you know.
Kathy, comments?
Sorry,
I just want to tell you that your code, your ordinance, says that these boards are in place for only two reasons: to take what this body refers to them, or what the city manager or borough manager refers to them. For the last, I'd say, 10 to 12 years, all of a sudden, these have been starting to become like, let's get together and help the department manager do this or that, or start a program. If that's what you want your boards to do, you need to change your code to say that. Because technically, you guys are the body. You're the public body that are supposed to listen to the complaints. If you want some further research, then you're going to refer it to your boards. That's how we're set up right now. If you want it changed, we have to change the ordinances to say how you want them. And right now, they don't function as far as doing what they're supposed to do. Mm. It's like Donnie says, they meet, he's given a report. I think that's Carl, that's what you did for utility board. He gave a report, this is going on in my department. If you want them to do something, you've got to say what you want them to do. Otherwise, you shouldn't have them. So, so it was not the board's responsibility for budget, but that was nice you took it on.
Well, I learned a lot, I can tell you that. And now I know where my dollars are going. I know that much. So.
But I just wanted to know that that's what it tells you, what the boards are supposed to be doing.
Okay.
Mr. Hogue?
Yes. Mr. Mayor, members of the Assembly, I think, first of all, the folks that have sat on the board need to be thanked for what they've done. But I think realistically, the clerk has a point, and Donnie Hayes has a point, is that as things exist, it's really not working, and so I do not support the continuation of this as an elected board. And, you know, one of the things I've seen from my very short time on this island is that most of these boards we have trouble filling, and there's a huge turnover in existing. And so at some point, I think there needs to be a centralization of the responsibility. It does not exist in the board as the ordinance are written. It exists in the department heads, and it exists in the fact that members of this small community can bring these matters to Donnie's attention, to the city manager's attention, and to our attention to deal with any issue that comes up. And we've done that in the past. So I personally do not support the continuation of most boards, and certainly not this one.
Okay, thank you. Cindy, do you have any input?
Just what I said before, I think we're in a transition, and having had Kathy's clarification, I think we should give them a chance to better understand how to supposed to operate and see how it goes.
Okay. So I guess the procedure here would be, if there's no more discussion by Assembly members, is to take a vote of the Assembly if they would like to retain the Parks and Rec Advisory Board. So
is there going to be an option whether it's elected or appointed, or is it just going to be is the motion to continue it as it is?
The motion was for it to be elected. Is that how it was in the past, Kathy?
Yeah, five-member elected.
Five-member elected board, John, is how it has been. So affirmative vote would be to keep it in that same capacity and number. So I guess will the clerk call the roll?
John Heverlick.
No.
John Hogue.
No.
Nancy.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
Kurt.
Yes.
And Mark.
Yes. So it, what was the tally there?
4-2.
It's okay, it passes 4-2. That's what I thought. Just wanted to make sure. 3-3, it wouldn't have passed. Okay, so this brings us to the review of the Public Safety Advisory Board. So I'd entertain a motion to retain the Public Safety Advisory Board as an elected body with five members. Is that how it was made up in the past, Kathy? Just like it said? Okay. So, for the sake of discussion, anyway, we need a motion.
So move. To retain the...
is there a second?
Well, second for the sake of discussion.
Okay, it's been moved by Member Wallhuter, seconded by Member Strand to retain the Public Safety Advisory Board. Any discussion?
Mr. Mayor, is there anybody from the audience to testify on this?
Sid, would you like to speak, being the chair of the Public Safety Advisory Board for so many years? And thank you for all your dedicated service.
Oh, thank you, Mark. I'm Sid Bacom, chair of the Public Safety Advisory Board. Been on the board for 14 years. It's been elected since the initiation. You know, we've always been elected. We've never had a problem filling our seats. It's always been one that we've done. The board's evolved over the years, as Kathy has said. Originally, it was set up to be an advisory board to the city council. And we used to get a lot of direction from city council, but over the years, things just go away. Public was always invited to come in and speak. We provided a voice for the public on safety issues that normally they would not want to come in here and speak at your venue. And there are quite a few people that don't. So, you know, I've been real appreciative that we could give them that service. But it seems that, you know, listening tonight to Kathy, that we're really not doing what we're supposed to be doing. And so, you know, it's a big choice whether you want to keep us to handle the small issues that, do you really need to hear them in here? I don't know. A lot of things come to us from the public. They go to Carl. They go to the chief, the police chief, or Sandy with EMS. They're at the meetings every month. So, you know, we have lots of answers to give where it doesn't have to come to this level to be dealt with. You have department heads that handle those situations. But for the most part, the public doesn't know where to go. So they come to this board. And that's pretty much it in a nutshell. We do the best we can.
It almost seems to me as though we need to restructure the way we, you know, the way we gather our information. Because it sounds like if we're the ones that we're supposed to hear all the complaints, and then we say, hey, Sid, would you guys take this on because it's directed toward your guys' board?
Right.
It almost seems backward to me, you know.
We don't turn the public down.
Right, no. Yeah. And neither do I. But I got a nice little letter from one of the members of our community here that appreciated the idea that you had this safety board that she could go to mm-hmm. and speak in front of, because she would not feel comfortable speaking in front of us. And so I called her back and talked to her about that, you know. And so it's, all these boards have my support simply because of that fact. It gives them a whole nother level of communication, and everything seems to get across to us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Kathy's right, though, and it does say established, there is created a Public Safety Advisory Board which shall review, investigate, and make recommendations on any matter referred by the City Council or the City Manager.
So we need to change something if it's going to continue differently than that.
Sounds like when we draft these ordinances, we have
to either reword that or we have to act differently, or the boards and committees as well. So
if things continue to go to the boards, then pretty soon the boards are setting policy instead of the council or the assembly. Even though we're the ones that we ultimately vote on it, but it's a kind of a murky area, actually.
Kurt?
Mr. Mayor, I mean, I can see Nancy's point, but you know, they may recommend a policy, but we're the ones that ultimately make the policy stick or not. So, and hopefully, they've already done all of the investigating and all the legwork and all of the, you know, and then they have very good reasons why this should be a policy. I'd rather have somebody explain to me why it should be a policy than to sit and sift through 15, 20 people, you know, coming to me with various points of view, and then let you know what I mean. So, no, I appreciate all the work you guys are doing.
Any more questions of Sid? Thank you, Sid. Kind of a stalemate here, not a stalemate, the what do we do
conundrum.
From here? Yeah, conundrum, there you go. If the boards aren't functioning like the ordinance says, then we have to rewrite the ordinance, or us as a body have to start. Is that the way you perceive it, Kathy? That's what you said earlier. I mean, since I've been on the council, I believe this is council / assembly now, it's going into my eighth year, this is the way we've done it.
I know, it's always been done wrong, even though when we've brought it up before, I tell the department heads too, you know, they think they have, when the committee started out, oh, we got to have regular scheduled meetings, it says, no, you do not. You only meet when there's work for you to do. Well, some of them are finally getting that idea now. Well, you guys just haven't really referred. Harbor's gotten a lot in the last couple of years because of all the projects that are going down there, and I can see where that has been a big help. But for these guys, the department has to hold these meetings, just to hold the meetings has not been real productive.
Well, if, for instance, the last board has recommended zero items to this body, in 3 years or whatever it was. I mean, I could see maybe still having them, but
that's why I think this is my personal opinion, just been working in it now, what, 13, 14 years. I can see you guys having an established board. I don't agree with it being elected because they have no authority. They have none. It is all with this, here. But I can see you having appointed ones and to pick up and look at problems that you have that you want them to look at. To have elected boards like we do does not make any sense.
Okay.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes, John?
Some of you know public safety is something near and dear to me since I'm down south, partly because I teach on public safety issues. And this is a board where there's been some very dedicated members, Sid leading the charge, and a lot of the other members have worked very long and hard on some issues. But there are a number of things that bother me with the continuation of this board. Number one, I know that Dale Stone was very concerned about the composition of this board. He was concerned that if there was a sensitive investigation, as we all know, drugs and alcohol are a big issue in this town, and the sensitivity of those investigations are significant, that he would lobby sometimes for who would or would not be elected because he was concerned that somebody would get elected to the board and abuse the position. I talked to Jim Agner on his views on the board. He, frankly, did not see the need for the board to continue. I reviewed about 6 to 8 months of board work, and partly, as Kathy said, because of the way they have been structured, the board has not dealt with issues from the assembly or the city council before that. The biggest issue we have is a drug problem and an alcohol problem in this town, and from that stems a lot of crime and a lot of our problems. And as far as I can tell, this board has never sat down proactively, for instance, with Petersburg Mental Health and other community stakeholders and said, what are we going to do about this? And so with thanks to those folks that have put up with things, but a lot of the things I sat on for only the few meetings I've been to that I've had to miss a number because of my travel schedule, is been micromanaging of things such as stop signs and speed limits. And there are tons of standards and literature for the police chief and the public works director to deal on those issues, as opposed to some board's personal opinion on what those issues should be. So I would suggest that, one, this board not continue to exist, and two, if we want to rewrite ordinances for advisory boards, that we consider that in mass and consider making them appointed boards. And so I do not believe that supporting the continued existence of the Public Safety Advisory Board is frankly in the community's best interest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hogue. Any more discussion? Sandy?
Sandy Dixon, the Fire and Rescue Director. I'm not a proponent of elected or appointed. Some of our discussion, however, was that an appointed board may be stacked, so you handpick the people that you want on the board so they favor your decisions. That was our discussion there, elected versus appointed. I think the board has been effective. granted that we don't always get direction from the assembly or the previous council to give us direction as what to do, but I do feel we were valuable in fielding some of the community concerns. I disagree with Mr. Hogue about how we have only been paying attention to personal complaints or issues and concerns, because people have come with deer population from the public, not just people that sit on our board, and traffic concerns like on Sandy Beach. So things like that, I think it's effective. I also feel it's effective to have support for our departments. So who's backing up the police department and the fire department when it comes to budget time? So, you know, they're listening to the community, the Public Safety Advisory Board are talking to the community and seeing the significance of what we do for the community as well. So when we have to come to the assembly to fight for our budgets or to support our training, you know, they're backing us up, and so we have that, just as we do the harbor. The harbor boards do that for their projects, and you remember how many people were coming in for their projects supporting that. And then how many projects has the assembly sent back to the harbor board to work on? That's all coming from the harbor side, not from the assembly. And so I would just take into consideration, if you're going to do it for one, you should do it for all. So
okay.
That's my
you,
input.
Any more discussion? Okay, will the clerk call the roll? This is affirmative vote will be to retain the Public Safety Advisory Board as an elected five-member board.
Correct.
Will the clerk please call the roll?
Mark.
Yes.
Kurt.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
John Hogue.
No.
John Haverlett.
Yes.
Nancy.
Yes.
Okay, it passes to keep the Public Safety Advisory Board as a elected five-member board, 5-1. So, and I think we need to have on a agenda in the near future how we're going to have the ordinances written as to the duties between the relationship between the assembly and the advisory boards, if we're going to want to do it like we're supposed to. Okay. Now we're on to new business, and the first item under new business is a resolution giving preliminary approval to offer borough land at public auction, and that land is lots 2, 3, 4, and 5 of block 263. I would entertain a motion to adopt resolution 2013-24.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved by Member Havlick, seconded by Member, he's been gone so long I can't remember his name. adopt this resolution. And there's a map included. We've all read the resolution. There's some the local people that live right in the area that expressed interest in buying this land. So it will be, if we approve this, it will be What date is the auction going to be, Kathy? December 16th, 2013.
The second meeting in December.
There will be a public auction to be held in conjunction with the regular meeting of that date. So, any discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Cindy.
Yes.
Nancy.
Yes. Was there a motion?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Everlett.
Yeah.
Kurt. Remember, he couldn't remember his name.
Couldn't remember his last name. It's getting late.
Hi, Kurt. John Hogue.
Yes.
John Haverlett.
Yes.
Mark.
Yes.
And Kurt.
Yes.
Okay, resolution 2013-24 passes, so there will be a public auction to sell lots 2, 3, 4, and 5 of Block 263 on December 16th. The next item under new business is consideration of a new professional services contract with our lobbyist, Ray Matuszewski from Juneau. I'd entertain a motion to approve that contract.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Okay.
Okay, was that Cindy?
Yes.
Okay, it's been moved by Member Walhooter, seconded by Member Logadakis to go into keep Ray Matuszewski hired in Juneau as our lobbyist, and this annual contract will include a $6,000 raise to $42,000 a year. Any discussion?
Is the raise because he requested it, or does he give us a proposal, or?
Pretty much in discussion between Ray and the city manager, he has asked for a raise. I think he's been our lobbyist for 5 years now, at least, I believe. Maybe six, but 5 years for sure, I think. And he's been at the same salary. I know he gave up an opportunity to apply to be Juneau's lobbyist this year. I think he probably could have done both, but he preferred not representing Juneau and Petersburg at the same time, and that job offer was, or that contract was around $80,000, if I'm not mistaken. So I think Ray does a good job for us. That's my two cents. Any other comments? Okay, will the clerk call the roll?
Kurt.
Mrs. Yes.
John Haverlett?
Yes.
Cindy?
Yes.
Nancy?
Yes.
John Hall?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes. Okay, at resolution, whatever the number was here, 2013-14. Nope, that's not it.
Nope,
it's just a new contract for Ray Matuszewski. It passed 6-0, so I guess the clerk will contact Ray. Seeing no communications listed on tonight's agenda, the next item is assembly discussion items. Any items for assembly discussion? Wasn't it communications or was it discussions where we had recognitions? Anybody have any recognitions? I don't see it listed on tonight's agenda. But, okay, seeing none, the next item for discussion is adjournment. Entertain a motion to go. Everybody jumped on that one. All those in favor say aye.
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 Okay, the meeting is adjourned.